French are glad to die for love. They delight in fighting duels. But I prefer a man who lives and gives expensive jewels. A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. A kiss may be grand, but it won't pay the rental on your humble flat or help you at the automat. Men grow cold as girls grow old, and we all lose our charms in the end. But square cut or pear shape, these rocks don't lose their shape. Diamonds are a girl's best friend.
But Natasha, of course, was her acting coach until 1955. This is one of the most important relationships in Marilyn's entire life. Natasha, you know, did one-on-one lessons with Marilyn, and she really pushes that enunciation that, you know, people really know Marilyn's early work for, when she really is making sure she pronounces every syllable and every word. And you know, that's Natasha's doing. Natasha could reportedly be pretty, I don't want to say mean, but she could be very harsh, especially with Marilyn. And there are rumors that Natasha was a lesbian who was in love with Marilyn, but I don't really, like I said, there's nothing really to prove that, but it's unlikely, even if she was a lesbian, that Marilyn slept with her, although that is a rumor out there, too. Because apparently everyone slept with Marilyn at one time.
Of course. Even I didn't. I wasn't born. Come on. Didn't you?
Yeah.
Come on, Marilyn. No, but I'm saying she did live with Natasha, and Natasha had a child, right? A 7-year-old daughter?
She did. That would have been in, like, 1950-ish. Mm-hmm. She did live with her. Marilyn reportedly had a suicide attempt in Natasha's house by overdosing pills. It was a whole thing. She only lasts, you know, a few months at Columbia. She does make one movie called Ladies of the Course. It has Adele Juergens in it, and it's a complete B movie. I don't know if you've seen it, Grace.
No, I have to. It's on Amazon Prime, and I keep passing it. And I heard it's a crappy movie, but I should just watch it. You know, it's there. It's not a lot of music, is there? I know.
I actually really like the movie.
Do you?
I don't think it's a bad movie. I just don't think it's a great movie.
Yeah, I'll check it out. I'll probably watch it tonight because it's right
there.
Yeah,
no. I think you'll like it. Mm-hmm. She is dropped, though, after, you know, only like 6 months with Columbia. Apparently, when Harry Cohen saw her on screen, he called her a fat pig and asked who she was sleeping with to get the part. There's also a story that Marilyn told in My Story about rejecting sleeping with Cohen. He's creepy. As far as studio bosses go, he's probably the creepiest.
The most repulsive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, she's just like, ew, you're gross. And he's like, well, if you think I'm gross, you're not going to sleep with me. Guess what? You're fired.
And you're fat.
And you're fat.
Yeah.
She was super fat.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, no, he wasn't a very nice person. We'll just leave it at that.
A lot of those powerful men just weren't.
Right. Marilyn, as we said before, is kind of seeing Fred Karger during this time. And for Christmas, she gives him a watch that is engraved with 12/25/1948. The watch cost her $500 because it was a gold watch. And, you know, she's on a 2-year payment plan. So one can assume that she thought they were going to last, but Karger broke up with her soon after that, saying that her mind was embryonic and there would be no way that she would be like a good role model for his daughter. Interestingly, though, Marilyn did connect with his mother and his sister, Anne and Mary Carter, and they actually attended her funeral. They were, you know, one of the few sets of people who were invited to Marilyn's funeral, and they did go, and Marilyn always had contact with them.
Yeah, it said she was always looking for a family. She would just find different people to be family.
Exactly. And, you know, she really loved the Cargers, and she would insert herself with families, but the Cargers were one of the few families that really welcomed her, and she always kept in contact with. And then on December 31st, 1948, Marilyn goes to a New Year's Eve party and she meets Johnny Hyde.
Oh, yes.
Now, Johnny Hyde is an older gentleman who is very, very short, but he is also one of the biggest agents in Hollywood at this time.
I read he was 5 feet. Is that possible?
That's probably about right, because he's almost a head shorter than Marilyn, and Marilyn's only 5'5" and a half.
Yeah.
Of course, she's wearing heels in the pictures, you know, where you can see that
easily
she's a lot
3-inch heels. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, he's probably about 5 foot tall. But she meets him, and for those who don't know, Johnny Hyde was a very big agent. He had represented Rita Hayworth. He really got things going. And on March 2nd, 1949, Johnny Hyde began to represent Marilyn. And this is really where Marilyn's career is going to kind of take a turn for the better. But, it's going too soon, because on May 27th, 1949, Marilyn is about to have her car repossessed, and she agrees to pose nude for a photographer she had met a couple months ago named Tom Kelly. Obviously, we know those pictures. It was eventually called the Red Velvet Sitting, and Marilyn was paid $50.
Was she nude, nude? Because I have never seen those pictures.
Yeah, no, she's nude, nude.
Get the potato sack when I... She was nude, nude. Okay.
Yeah, she's nude, nude. There's the red. It's the red velvet sitting. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the famous calendar comes from those photos. Mm-hmm. And Marilyn's paid $50. Now, there is a thing that she needed to pay her rent. That's probably not true, because she was living with Hyde. I don't want to say regularly, but, you know, pretty much living with Hyde at this point, and he probably would have paid her rent for her apartment just so they keep up appearances that they weren't living together. But, you know, a car is a much more glamorous item, so when the nude calendar story comes out, she, you know, was like, oh, I need it for rent, because if you say, oh, I need it for my car payments, like, well, you could live without a car, but you can't really live without a roof over your head.
Yes.
But most likely it was actually for her car. These pictures then would end up being sold for $500 to a calendar company by Tom Kelly. And then, of course, Hugh Hefner, a few years later, went by the photos from the calendar company, and he would put them in his first issue of Playboy magazine. However, I do want to point out that Marilyn having to pose nude to keep her car really does contradict the rumor that she was like a kept woman by Johnny Hyde. You know, they obviously had a symbiotic relationship with one another. He reportedly did love her and asked her to marry him multiple times, which she always denied. But, you know, if she was being kept and supported by this guy, there'd be no reason to pose nude for, you know, for her car payment.
Yeah, that sounds weird. And also I heard about Marilyn is that she really, you know, nudity was no big deal to her. It was just like second nature. Okay, here I go. I'm naked and here I am. She didn't care.
Exactly. So you know, she was very proud of her body. She was very comfortable with her body. And, you know, I don't think anyone can take that away from her. And I think she was a very just happy person. She did go around with Hyde. He, you know, she would be his date for parties. They would, you know, go and do a bunch of stuff together. And he really got her name out there. And then in December of 1949, she signs her agreement to appear in John Huston's The Asphalt Jungle. This is probably because of Hyde, although Lucille Ryman would eventually attempt to take credit for this casting. But she's, you know, she's going to play the part of Angela, and they're giving her $300 a week to, you know, sit there and be a gun mall. Yeah. If anyone, you know, hasn't seen The Asphalt Jungle, it's by John Huston. I highly recommend it.
I haven't.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good movie. It's very much from the time, obviously, but it's a good movie.
I never really liked jewelry heist movies, but I guess it's noir. I'll have to look at it because I've read really good things about it, and I'm ashamed I haven't seen it. So I will see it.
Yeah, no, it's I highly recommend it. I'm pretty biased, though, so but I do recommend it. So 1950, you know, comes in, and Marilyn signs a contract in March of 1950 to star in All About Eve. And, you know, of course, All About Eve is considered one of the greatest films ever made. Marilyn has a very small but, you know, key role.
I love her part. That's great. Yeah.
It is. I like the thing where she's like, why do they all look like rabbits? you know, her role's significant. It has George Sanders and, of course, Betty Davis in it. Supposedly, Zsa Zsa Gabor was on set because she thought that Marilyn was trained to sleep with George Sanders.
Yes, I read the same thing years ago, that she would show up at lunch, do everything, and watch her George. Yeah,
she's just a very interesting. Shaw's just an interesting person. We'll have to talk to her over during her 1950s blonde week. You know, when Fox sits there, they're watching Marilyn. They're very pleased with what they're seeing. And on May 11th, they draw up a contract to rehire Marilyn, and it's going to be for a year.
At so Fox, from May 11th, right?
So it would be from May 11th, 1950 to May 11th, 1951. And then, oddly enough, only a couple weeks later, Marilyn is fired by Fox.
That's weird.
It was a very, very odd. And then she's, you know, going through and she's signing deals to get, you know, to really on her own, like to become, you know, a perfume spokesperson and stuff like that. And, you know, she's kind of floundering right now, you know, trying to figure out what she's going to do with everything. And then Marilyn has a screen test in December for Fox. And Fox rehires her. It's very odd. I don't really know how else to describe it. Fox is like letting her go and then rehiring her and then letting her go and then rehiring her. But she finally, you know.
That was her home from then on, wasn't it?
It was. And really, it's only a few months where they're not, you know, where she's been let go. So she's basically just instantly thrown into, like, doing a screen test for Fox. She tests out for As Young As You Feel. She gets the part. And on December 16th, Johnny Hyde, you know, he's kind of run down. He's really been advocating for Marilyn. And he goes to Palm Springs because he wants to, you know, feel better. And he thinks that he's been having the flu for the last month. The next day, Johnny Hyde has a heart attack. And the following day, December 18th, Johnny Hyde passes away. He passes away at the Cedars of Lebanon Hospital. Marilyn is in his hospital room and reportedly holds him while he passes away. She then returns to their shared home, and she finds that she has been locked out and all of her belongings have been placed out front, except for her jewelry and furs and stuff like that. Johnny Hyde's family. It's Johnny Hyde's family.
Sounds familiar, right? Who he? Betty Grable's boyfriend.
Yeah, no, it's not a positive experience. And, you know, Marilyn's obviously absolutely devastated. And she moves in with Natasha Lettice. Now, this is about when she attempts her suicide. Some places put it as being Christmas Eve of 1950. We don't know for sure, but we'll just go with that date because that's the popular date. And Natasha discovers Marilyn inside her room, and Marilyn has like this goo seeping out of her mouth, and it apparently was undissolved pills. Natasha did have to rush Marilyn to the hospital, and they ended up pumping her stomach. Natasha, though, was not the most giving person. Marilyn did get out with a few of her furs that she had gotten from Johnny Hyde, and one of them she gave Natasha for Christmas because Natasha demanded a, you know, Christmas present. And then Natasha, you know, I guess Natasha has like a pain of guilt and she's like, I can't really accept this. She gives it back to Marilyn, but of course there's a condition. Natasha owes money on her house. She discovers that she's about $1,000 short because she's going to end her, or, you know, she's going to lose her house. So Marilyn goes and sells the, you know, mink stole that she had just given Natasha so that Natasha can keep her house. Mm-hmm. Marilyn was always, you know, kind of like that. In 1951, she meets Eli Kazan and Arthur Miller. Of course, both of them will have significant, you know, roles or impact on Marilyn's life, I guess you can say.
Especially Arthur Miller.
Yeah. It's kind of weird. She falls in love with Arthur, but he goes, you know, back after a few weeks to his wife, Mary, in New York. He's, you know, trying to get Marilyn out of his head, but they're still kind of friends. So she starts sleeping with Kazan, and she's going to have an affair with Kazan that, you know, it lasts like a few months. You know, he really takes care of her. He gives her, you know, acting advice and everything. And Fox finally decides, hey, you know, we should make things with this Monroe girl official. So after they had rehired her in December of 1950, on May 11th, 1951, when that one-year contract, you know, would have run out, they signed Marilyn to a new contract. But interestingly, they don't give her a pay raise from what the last contract was going to be. But the idea was they would sign her to a 6-year contract and she would be paid up to $2,500 a week by 1957. Of course, Marilyn's going to buck that. Mm-hmm. But it's a pretty standard contract. It's also a pretty good, contract. When Jane Mansfield was offered one by Warner Brothers, she was paid almost $1,000 less than that, and that was a few days, you know, or a few years later. So Marilyn's got a pretty solid contract from Fox. In her contract, it is also stipulated that an extra $250 a week is going to go to Natasha Lettice, who is obviously now hired by Fox as Marilyn's private acting coach.
Who's always on the scene. When did she do Clash by Night?
Clash by Night, that was like 1950. Let's see, that would have been 1951.
That's what I thought.
That obviously was a loan out to RKO. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, so she, I mean, we can just jump there because there's really not a whole lot with Marilyn. She's just kind of working. And then, as you just pointed out, in 1951, on September 24th, Marilyn starts filming Clash by Night. This movie, you really see Marilyn put on, like, her serious acting chops. I personally really like the movie.
Me too. I love the movie. I thought she was absolutely adorable in the movie. And good. And she said that Barbara Stanwyck treated her excellently and was very kind to her. And she played Peg, and she was marrying, she was engaged to Barbara Stanwyck's hunka hunka burnin' love, Keith Andes, I believe. And she worked at a sardine factory. And it was a very good movie. I mean, I'm not really telling you the big thing of it, but I agree with April. I would recommend seeing it, and you'd see a really, she didn't have a huge part, but she did a really good job.
She did. It's just, it's a really good movie.
It is.
You see a completely different side of Marilyn. It's obviously a pretty successful movie because Fox thinks, hey, we should put her in dramas as well. And so they start doing costume tests for Don't Bother to Knock, which, if anyone hasn't seen it, Marilyn plays a deranged babysitter.
I've seen that one.
Yeah, it's a very interesting movie. But I really like it. You can see serious acting potential there.
Potential. But I didn't, you know, there's who also starred in it was Richard Widmark. And, you know, she was okay, but I didn't really buy her in this film all the time. I felt that she was acting too much.
You know, I can see that. I actually really liked the movie. I think that she's a little more realistic in certain scenes, but I can also see where she's at overacting in it. But I don't know. I would say it's probably one of my favorite Marilyn movies just because it's so far removed
from her image. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, one of Anne Bancroft's first movies. And of course, Anne Bancroft would really gain fame, you know, for The Graduate and The Miracle Worker.
Isn't that amazing when you think of The Graduate? Because it was Dustin Hoffman Star Day. I don't know if it was today or yesterday. And they had The Graduate. And she was only 37 years old when you think about it, right? She's supposed to be some old middle-aged broad. She looked fabulous, and she was only 37.
Yeah, and he's 29. I really love The Graduate. It's people should watch it. If you haven't seen The Graduate, you should watch it. Although I didn't watch it until, you know, a few years ago. I don't know. I always bypass it because I don't really do a whole lot of movies, you know, from that time. But I finally watched it, and it's just an excellent movie. With our Marilyn thing, Marilyn just kind of ends the year by going to the African Queen premiere with her on-and-off-again boyfriend, Nicholas Ray, which, of course, we talked about Nicholas Ray quite a bit with Gloria Graham.
I didn't know she dated him. I knew that he was on her list of guys she wanted to. Shelley Winters wrote about it in her book because they were roommates, and that they each made a list about men they wanted to know in a biblical way. And he was one of them, and I didn't know that she actually had a relationship with him.
Yeah, they dated on and off for about a year and a half, really until she meets Joe DiMaggio.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, speaking of Joe DiMaggio, a few months after the African Queen premiere, Marilyn meets Joe DiMaggio. That would have been probably around March of 1952. And, you know, Marilyn's first date with Joe is at Villanova, which, of course, is now the Rainbow. And Marilyn reportedly did not want to go. Even she admitted she did not want to go. But, you know, people are like, oh, he's not like other, you know, sportsmen. She agrees to go, and they spend the whole night just talking together.
I read she was 2 hours late.
She was 2 hours late. She thought he was going to be really showy and late.
Like a football player, she really didn't know what baseball was.
Yeah, I don't know how much I believe that, if I'm honest with you. Just because Joe DiMaggio was such a, like, well-known personality, I find it a little unlikely that she had no idea who he was, but that's what she claimed.
Yeah.
You know, and 1952 is really Marilyn's year. You know, a few months after she meets Joe, she does costume tests for Niagara on her birthday, June 1st, 1952. It is announced that Marilyn is going to play the role of Lorelai Lee in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. But before she can do Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, she has to fly up to Canada so that she can film Niagara. They do film part of it in Buffalo, New York, and Marilyn spends the weekends with, you know, Joe DiMaggio. She famously sprains her ankle because she slips on some rocks in the river in Canada while she's doing it. It's just, it's a whole thing. She holds up production because she has this huge bandage on her leg. But, you know, she can't really, I guess you could say she can't really help that, you know. But she's doing all that.
She was gorgeous in that red dress in Niagara. I mean, she was.
She was.
Unbelievable. And I have to say, Jean Peters is really a pretty woman, and she did marry Howard Hughes. She definitely married him, and she got offered millions and of bucks to talk about Howard, and she never did. But Jean Peters was absolutely beautiful, but she was no Marilyn. Marilyn came on wearing that red dress and dancing to that song She had this lover boy there, and Joseph Cotton was in it as well. And I liked Niagara. Did you?
I do like Niagara. I think it's a good movie. I think it's a solid movie. I don't think it's the best movie ever, but I think it's a good movie.
No, I don't think it's the best movie ever, but I enjoy it. I thought it was.
Yeah. So, you know, she's sitting there in Niagara doing it. I know I just told the river story. That's from River of No Return. My brain gets these movies confused for some reason. I think because they're both kind of on the East Coast. But anyway, so she's sitting there. She's doing Niagara, you know, and that movie's really going to skyrocket her in 1953. But, you know, 1952, she starts doing costume tests for Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. And after she's back, you know, from filming for Niagara, she's doing costume tests for Gentlemen Prefer Blondes in October. And, you know, she's just really going up. I mean, there's not like a whole lot to say really about this, you know, point besides her star is just really going up. 1953 was definitely Marilyn's year. That is when she has Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and Niagara and How to Marry a Millionaire come out.
Which is my favorite. I love How to Marry a Millionaire. I think she is so cute in that film. And her and David Wayne together are absolutely adorable. I love her in that movie.
You know, they really are. And interestingly, Marilyn basically filmed it back-to-back from Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. I mean, she finished Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and like a week later, she's having to film How to Marry a Millionaire. She supposedly did all of her costume tests for How to Marry a Millionaire while she was doing Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
And she got along great with Rosalind and Russell. People were waiting for this big cat fight or something, but Rosalind said they did fine. And she helped. Marilyn was so nervous that she would walk her out to the set with her. They would go together.
Wait, are we talking about Jane Russell?
Oh, yes. Jane Russell. I'm sorry. Those
no,
Russells.
You're fine. I'm thinking, am I going this nuts?
No, I'm going this nuts. Jane Russell. Yes. The full-figured girl. Yeah.
No, Jane. Interestingly, this will probably come out about the time where their dresses from the Little Rock number are going to be up for auction. That's on, I think, September 24th at Julian's.
I'd love to see those dresses. I can only imagine. You know, they used to call Marilyn fat, and she would probably, don't you think she'd be like a size 4 today or 6 at the biggest?
So I've written quite a bit about this. So I just want to start out by saying there's very few direct size correlations between 1950s clothing and what we have today, because clothing was expected to be taken in. So Maryland's clothing would be about a size 4 in the bust, a double 0 in the waist, wow, and a size 2 in the hip.
Yeah, I mean, it just kills me that people used to say she's fat. Even now, I mean, people, she was fat. I don't know what anyone liked her for, but she was not ever fat in the least. And
No. And people don't really know about vanity sizing, and they think that the 1950s was about, you know, really full-figured women. It really wasn't. There's an old I Love Lucy episode where they sit there and say, oh, you know, Lucy's a perfect size 12.
Yes.
A size 12 is about a size 2-4 today.
Yes.
And like you said, clothing went up by 2 inches. You don't see, because, you know, it was expected that you were going to go get your clothing taken in. Mm-hmm. We don't see 2-inch increases in, like, the bust, waist, or hip measurements until you get over a size 12. Mm-hmm. For that, they all move up by an inch. So to put this in perspective, if you are a size 6 today, you would have to go up to a size 10 to find the next size up if you were looking at 1950s clothing. So it's everything was basically went up by 2 sizes versus, you know, 1 size like it does now.
During this time, she's dating Joe DiMaggio, right?
Mm-hmm.
Heavy duty.
Yeah, they're going.
But I don't ever get this whole Joe DiMaggio thing, because he's like Mr. Italian guy and he's so jealous. And he meets her. He asks somebody to set him up. She's Marilyn Monroe. He knows who she is. She's this va-va-va-voom vixen. And, you know, then he gets mad because she's who she is. I think we talked about that, again, with one of the actresses that we were talking about. And it's just like, you know, she's not going to become, if you want an Italian housefrau, marry an Italian housefrau. To make you spaghetti and meatballs. Don't get involved with Marilyn Monroe, and don't get mad at her because she doesn't conform to what you want her to be.
Yeah, I think Joe's stuff is, like you said, I think he thought, oh, well, I have a lot of money, so she'll just be fine with all my money. He didn't really realize how she was set on, like, the love and adoration that she would get, as well as, you know, like, the money's nice, but she's looking at it as, you know, career fulfillment, and the public loves her. They went about these things from 2 completely different angles. So it's really hard, you know, it's really hard to say what Joe thought would happen, besides I think he just thought, well, I have enough money for the both of us.
Yeah, but he also wanted her to change 100%. He wanted her to dress right, less sexy. He wanted her to be 100% what she wasn't. He was a neatnik. She would throw her shoes here, there, and everywhere. They were just total opposites.
They were. And like I said, I really just think he thought, well, you know, she'll tone down once she's a housewife, and she'll become a housewife because I have lots of money and I'm famous. You know, just a very old-fashioned way of looking at it, you know, like, why do you have to work if I make all this money? And, you know, she'll learn how to be domestic, the domestic goddess, after, you know, she's living at home and not having to work.
Well, fooled him.
Yeah, most definitely. You know, Marilyn, though, as you have pointed out, is going very, very strong with Joe over the course of 1953. In July of that year, she goes up to Canada, and that's the story about twisting her ankle in the river, which for some reason I thought was Niagara, which I'm going completely nuts. And this is when she returns from filming River of No Return, and she meets Milton Greene. Now, of course, Milton Greene is going to be basically her creative soulmate. I don't know how else to describe it. She meets him the day that she comes into Los Angeles, and supposedly she said, "You're just a boy," and he said, "And you're just a girl." I don't know, Milton Green and Marilyn just had this really great friendship, and I don't want to say love story, but they were just soulmates in every possible way. Mm-hmm. You know, she absolutely loved Milton, but of course the relationship will strengthen in the coming years. For right now, it's not, you know, quite as intense as it's going to get. And then on September 28th, 1953, Marilyn receives the news that Grace Goddard has passed away. According to Bernice, Marilyn's sister, they are told that she's dead, but they don't know how she died, and they assume it was because Grace had liver cancer, but in actuality, Grace died of a barbiturate overdose.
She killed herself, or was
she
it
did.
Accidental?
She killed her. No, it was ruled a suicide.
Uh-huh.
You know, Marilyn's reportedly devastated. Grace's funeral is held a few days later. Marilyn is supposedly in attendance, and so is Jim Dowertree, who reported, you know, seeing Marilyn there, and he would claim that that was really the last time that he ever saw Marilyn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 1953, it really just kind of ends on a bang. I guess there's no other way to say it. You know, Marilyn's extremely popular. She's doing really well for herself over the course of 1953. And then it's proposed by Fox that Marilyn make a movie called The Girl in Pink Tights with Frank Sinatra. It's scheduled to begin filming on December 7th, and Marilyn does not show up. And Daryl Zanuck calls Marilyn, and he's basically like, "Why aren't you coming? You know, where are you? You have to film this movie." And Marilyn absolutely refuses. So Daryl calls Natasha, and he's like, "Hey, you know, you have to get Marilyn to come in." And Marilyn, you know, Natasha calls Marilyn, obviously, and this is really the beginning of the end of Marilyn's relationship with Natasha. Marilyn is absolutely furious that Natasha would, you know, take Daryl Zanuck's side over hers. Although I really can't blame Natasha, because if Marilyn works, so does Natasha. But, you know, regardless, I can also see why Marilyn is pretty hurt by it. Marilyn is just not having it, though. She does not want to, you know, work on The Girl in Pink Tights. And, you know, it's put off for a little bit. They agree to film the movie in January. And Marilyn's just like, nope, not going to do it. And she flies off to San Francisco to be with Joe and his family for Christmas. And she flies under the name of Miss Norma Jean Dowertree on December 23rd, 1953. On January 4th, 1954, Marilyn is officially suspended. And, you know, Fox just isn't having it. Marilyn's still refusing to come back. And so Marilyn, in kind of a, like, big, you know, well, like, you know, I can do what I want, marries Joe DiMaggio on January 14th, 1954, at the San Francisco courthouse. Interestingly, she shaved 2 years off of her age, making herself 25.
Well, why not?
Yeah.
If you can. Is this where we're stopping? Are we stopping at 1964?
Let's see. I thought we could finish 1954 and then we could start 1955.
Oh, yeah, 64. She wasn't even alive. Okay, so we'll finish this, and then we'll stop at 55.
Yeah, we're almost done with it.
Okie dokie, everybody. We're still going. Here we go.
So she marries Joe, you know, and on the 24th of January, Joe and Marilyn return to Los Angeles. And, you know, when they had first gotten married, Fox had briefly unsuspended her, but then she says, and then they were like, "But you still have to make The Girl in the Pink Tights."
Marilyn sends a telegram on the 25th that says, hey, sorry, I'm not making the girl in the pink tights. It's horrible. So on the 26th, Marilyn is again suspended from, you know, Fox, which this is going to add time to her contract, and she's also not being paid during these suspensions. I just want to point that out. Mm-hmm. And so on the 28th, Marilyn flies back to San Francisco. Joe had left for New York a couple days before, and he also flew back to San Francisco. And they decide to go and get their passport photos because Marilyn is going to go on a tour of Korea, and John and Joe is going to tour Japan because Japan is very into baseball players, and he's also going to help coach Japanese baseball players while Marilyn's going to perform in Korea. And so, you know, on February 1st, 1954, Marilyn and Joe arrives in Tokyo, and a couple days later, she goes to perform in Korea for the troops in Korea. Her first performance was on February 9th, 1954, when she visited the Brady Air Force Base. That was in Japan. She also did tours in Japan. My brain's just not feeling it. February 16th is when she arrives in Korea, and she performs for the 1st Marine Division as well as the 7th Infantry. Most of her show days, she had two or three performances that she did every single day. And, of course, Korea is extremely popular. Marilyn, you know, is just amazed how many people have shown up for these. You know, she's seeing the crowds of like 100,000 soldiers. Michael Caine, you know, the famous actor, was reportedly in the crowd for one of those shows. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just a huge thing. And Marilyn is just absolutely pumped as she leaves. She, you know, arrives back in Tokyo and she says to Joe, "You've never heard crowds cheer like that." And Joe says, "Yes, I have."
Yes, he has. He certainly has. In one of those huge baseball stadiums. Boy.
Yeah. Marilyn is kind of, you know, like crestfallen. I also want to point out that Marilyn did perform with some sort of thumb injury. We don't know exactly how she got it, although we do know that Joe injured it. It's just the story changed multiple times. Mm-hmm. The first story is that she went in to hug him from behind. He didn't know it was her, and he, like, you know, threw her arms off of him and injured her thumb. The other story is that she went to hug him from the front. He didn't want to hug her, and he threw her arms off of him. Or the third story is that they were fighting while he was packing a suitcase. She had her thumb, you know, like on the edge of the suitcase, and he slammed it down, the suitcase down on her thumb.
Ouch. Anyway, that happened is ouch. We know Joe is known to have a temper. That's for sure.
Yeah. It's not a positive experience. Their marriage is just, you know, not so hot. She does film There's No Business, or like Show Business, or, you know, in the mid part of 1954, really during the summer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a couple pictures where she's with Marlon Brando because she is watching him film Desiree while she's in her clothes, and she has a lot of bruising on her arm. Luella Parsons actually noticed it and talked about it in her column, and she had asked Marilyn about it, and Marilyn told Luella, "Oh, I bite myself in my sleep," and Luella was just like, "Okay, sure."
Yeah, right.
These are gigantic bruises.
Yeah.
She finishes the 7 year, or the 7 year, she finishes There's No Business Like Show Business. The movie was not particularly successful. It just wasn't a very good movie. I personally like it, but it's very mindless fluff.
Yeah, it is.
It has Dan Daly and Ethel Merman, Donald O'Connor and Mitzi Gaynor in it. But, you know, I don't know. I really like the movie. But Marilyn had agreed to do it because if she made There's No Business Like Show Business, she would be cast as the girl in The 7 Year Itch. And of course, that's exactly what happened. Fox came through. And on September 15th, 1954, Marilyn first met Gina Lola Brigida, and then she goes out on the New York streets and she films her famous skirt blowing scene for The 7 Year Itch. This wasn't the happiest night. Supposedly, Joe came with his friend Walter Mitchell, saw that Marilyn's skirt was being blown above her head numerous times, you know, for the subway skirt scene, mm-hmm. and that, you know, there were spectators whistling at her, and he got mad and he went back to their hotel.
Right.
Amy Green would remember the following day seeing Marilyn, and Marilyn's back was basically black and blue because Joe had beat her for it. You know, there's others who claim it was just a screaming match. But there's quite a few who support the physical abuse allegation.
Yes. And see the heavy makeup she puts on to try to cover the bruises.
Yeah. It wasn't good.
No.
And so, however that night went, Marilyn and Joe's marriage really ended on that night. They did return to New York the next day, They returned to Los Angeles the next day. You know, Marilyn just not having it with him. He goes back to New York only a week later, and he comes back on October 2nd. And he finds Marilyn having breakfast with Sidney Skolsky, and she tells him, hey, I'm going to divorce you. And the fact that she has to do it in front of somebody, I think, is pretty telling.
I think so, too. Yeah.
You know, and so she's sitting there. She's absolutely, you know, she's reportedly pretty devastated. On October 4th, she tells Billy Wilder that she can't come in to film scenes for The 7 Year Itch because she's sick, when in actuality she calls Harry Brand, who works for Fox Publicity, and she's like, hey, I'm filing for divorce. And October 5th, 1954, you know, the divorce, I guess you could say, the divorce heard around the world. You know, happens, and Joe is handed his papers while he's watching TV. Interestingly, Marilyn had hired Jerry Geisler as her attorney because we all know he made the rounds.
Mm-hmm.
And press are sitting in front of Marilyn's home, but she actually doesn't come out until the following day, October 6th, at 10:55 a.m., and that is where she announces her divorce officially. She's bawling. I think everyone has seen pictures from her that day. She looks absolutely radiant. I mean, I will say that. You know, and Joe does not take their divorce well. On October 9th, he sent her a letter detailing how much he loved her. He was continuously telling the press how much he loved her. He basically thought she was kind of flying off the handle and they would get together again. That obviously did not happen. So Joe decides on October 20th, 1954, to send private investigators to follow Marilyn around. They followed everywhere she went. We know that she went to parties when she was going to the Fox lot. I mean, it was really creepy.
Wasn't Frank Sinatra in some way involved with this? Is like Joe's partner in crime?
He was. He had helped Joe get in touch with the PI, apparently. But, of course, on November 5th, 1954, the Rock Door Raid happens. And I won't go too deeply into this, but basically, Joe's told by his private investigators that Marilyn's in the apartment of Hal Schaefer, her voice coach. We do know now that she probably was having an affair with Hal Schaefer, but, I mean, she was separated, too. And Joe's, you know, like, I'm going to go catch him. He's with Frank Sinatra. Frank's like, hey, I'm going to come along too. So they both go and they beat down the door of 39-year-old Florence Codd. Cox is obviously awoken by somebody breaking down her apartment door, and eventually she will file a lawsuit, and I think she'll get a settlement of roughly $100,000.
Hey, knock down my door, Frank and Joe.
I'll
take it. What the heck?
Right?
Yeah.
No, that would be my thing, too. Yeah, because that'd be about $1 million today.
Yes.
And then on the 7th, of November, Marilyn enters the Cedars of Lebanon Hospital, where she gets surgery for her endometriosis. There is film footage of that. I think most people have seen it. Marilyn is basically like shoved in a corner, trying to hide her face. But you know, people just aren't very considerate that she's dealing with a hard time. Although Joe does reportedly pick her up for Cedars of Lebanon and take her back to her house. And then on the 18th of November, Marilyn sees Ella Fitzgerald perform at the Tiffany Club. Now, this is commonly confused with Ella's performance at the Macombo, which would actually take place in March of 1955 when Marilyn was in New York. So that story that everyone shares about how, you know, Marilyn got Ella a job at the Macombo, that part probably is true. But Marilyn wasn't in the front row every night because she was in New York. So it was physically impossible for her to be in the front row every night. She was in the front row for two nights at the Tiffany Club, and that was also, you know, Marilyn's first appearance since her endometriosis surgery.
Yeah.
So, you know, the rest of 1954, Marilyn's just kind of, you know, sitting there. She's trying to figure out how to get out of her contract with Fox, or at least make it so that the terms are more favorable to her. Melton Green recommends her to an attorney who supposedly says, hey, your contract is null and void. You don't have to do anything that you want to. You know, you don't have to work for Fox. This contract is a bunch of lies. And Marilyn believes them. So Marilyn, you know, fires her agent. She tells Fox that she no longer is going to work for them. And she moves to New York around Christmas of 1954. And I guess that's when we should probably end on this.
Yeah, and we can start with her big Manhattan adventure.
Yeah.
What a life she had, you guys. I mean, really. So I next week we're going to do from, what, 55 to
62, and then I figured we could do one whole thing on her death.
Which is easy to do because there's so many theories, so many things to talk about. And maybe like the last days leading to her death, because I really don't know what happened, and I'll have to read that. But the days leading up to her death and the time of her death. So yeah, so we're going to do. There's a lot of juicy stuff between 1955 and 62, and horrible stuff, and then of course her death. So this is part one, and thank you so much again, April. You were fabulous as usual. And I'm going to miss you when we're done with our series. This has been such a fun one.
I know, where are we
going
to do? I'll have to figure something else out for Sunday.
Yes, this is so much fun. And, you know, when we talked about the children, I forgot another one who wrote a Mommy Dearest book was Maria Riva about Marlene. There's so many Mommy Dearests or Daddy Dearests around there, mostly Mommy Dearests, but there are so many. Anyway, hope you enjoyed this. Hope you're enjoying our series. And we will be back next week. And thank you, everybody. And thank you, April.
Thanks, Grace.
Bye.
The French are glad to die for love. They delight in fighting duels. But I prefer a man who lives and gives expensive jewels. A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. A kiss may be grand, but it won't pay the rental on your humble flat or help you at the automat mail, grow cold. cold as girls grow old, and we all lose our charms in the end. But square cut or pear shape, these rocks don't lose their shape. Diamonds are a girl's best friend. Tiffany's. To me, Harry Winston, tell me all about it. There may come a time when a lass needs a lawyer, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. There may come a time when a hard-boiled employer thinks you're awful nice, but get that ice or else no dice. He's your guy when stocks are high, but beware when they start to descend. It's then that those louses go back to their spouses. Diamonds are a girl's best friend.